From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. We talk with the former federal prosecutor about the Russia investigation since the president fired the FBI director.
It's really sort of escalated the need to have an independent counsel. The most important thing is that the public have confidence.
So far, the legislature is not putting money into an infrastructure fund. One group thinks the lawmakers should.
No one wants to be the next Flint. No one wants their house falling in a sinkhole. No one wants to even blow a tire on Michigan's roads.
We'll talk about a whole new approach in treating addiction problems.
7 out of 10 companies in America have opioid problems in their offices.
And we'll talk with one of the women testifying against Dr. Larry Nassar, who's charged with sexual assault of underage girls.
The culture of abuse is a societal response. It's the way we handle disclosures of assault.
But first, here's the latest news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. On today's show,
we are not the Department of Prosecution. We are the Department of Justice, which means we do the right thing. If people don't have confidence in that going forward, I think it really creates chaos.
We'll talk with a former federal prosecutor about the Russia investigation now that President Trump has fired the FBI director. But first, roads, bridges, sewer lines, water systems, and all the other infrastructure in the state is, by multiple assessments, in trouble in Michigan. Two studies say that the state needs to spend $4 billion a year. The governor wants at least $1.2 billion a year to get infrastructure back into decent shape. None of that's happened. So the governor established a temporary solution called the Michigan Infrastructure Fund. The governor included $20 million in his budget for that fund. The legislature is so far not interested in putting any money into it. Joining me now is Mike Nystrom. He's Executive Vice President of the Michigan Infrastructure and Transportation Association. That group is leading an effort called Fix My State. Mike, it's not as if there are not failing infrastructure stories in the news, so why is the legislature ignoring the Michigan Infrastructure Fund, which is for critical problems in municipalities?
I think that's the big question right now. We're wondering what the heck they're thinking in Lansing, and we're hoping that the general public's going to follow suit, start asking their elected officials, what's the real priorities in Lansing? We have failures in Fraser. We have the water situation in Flint. We have literally sinkholes happening across the state. We've had them in the UP. We've had them in Hamburg Township. Our roads and bridges are obvious. This time of year, they're just in terrible shape. Any driver out there knows that it's literally jarring to drive on Michigan's roads, and yet the legislature zeroed out the Michigan Infrastructure Fund that the governor had proposed in his budget.
Now, the legislature, we talk about roads and bridges. The legislature, not all that long ago, raised taxes and fees to pay for road repair. Why wasn't that enough?
Well, $1.2 billion was approved in the fall of 2015. It's phased in. So we're seeing just the startup of that. Half of it comes through user fees, such as gas taxes and registration fees. The other half, $600 million, is proposed beginning next year, 2018 through 2021, where we would see general funds being used. Our concern, however, is if they can't approve $20 million proposed by the governor to start helping local communities maybe address situations like Flint and Fraser, how do we have any hope that because the priorities aren't there to do a small amount like $20 million, that they're ever going to approve $600 million in general funds to fix our roads? It really puts a pause on that priority.
You talked about roads being jarring. The American Society of Civil Engineers Infrastructure Report Card found driving on roads in Michigan cost each driver $540 per year because of wear and tear. 11.1% of bridges are rated structurally deficient. Our drinking water is at risk. We're dumping raw sewage into the Great Lakes. Those two things are another $16 billion to fix. Government reacts to crisis in most cases. There's no indication anyone's going to die tomorrow, so no crisis, right?
The problem is we do have crisis. We're on national news with Flint. We have homes falling into sinkholes in Fraser. There are situations happening that are crises to families out there. Everyone across the state recognizes this. There have been two recent surveys that have talked about infrastructure as the top priority for voters in those surveys. And so That has never been the case before. It's always normally jobs in the economy are normally number one in most surveys that are done. In these two recent polls, I think folks are waking up to the fact that this is a concern for everyone. No one wants to be the next Flint. No one wants their house falling in a sinkhole. No one wants to even blow a tire on Michigan's roads. What's funny is we have this Pure Michigan campaign going on here in Michigan. It's award-winning. It's just a great campaign. We want folks from other states to come visit our greatest natural resources. You're going to drive on our roads that are in awful shape, and you're going to come to our beaches, which 25% of them in the past couple of years have been shut down due to E. coli contamination. That's kind of a contradiction in terms if you think about it. We really have to address these issues, put the foundation back in place to have a true Pure Michigan campaign.
Government compartmentalizes things into separate funds, separate agencies, state, local venues, all separate problems. What kind of effort is there within the state to come up with a real strategy, an overarching strategy that deals with all these different infrastructure needs?
Well, the governor has certainly put a priority on it. He named the 21st Century Infrastructure Commission, which I was a part of, along with 26 other individuals, put a lot of hard work into the report that was issued just before Christmas in 2016. And obviously the governor sees that infrastructure is important to the turnaround here in Michigan. So ultimately, I think he's leading the charge. There's some in the legislature that agree that this has to be a priority going forward. However, the leadership right now just is not focused on it. They've put some money towards Flint. Obviously, we had to address that catastrophic issue. But long term, we need to start doing an annual appropriation to address issues before they become catastrophic events, before we run into the Frasers and other situations like that. The drain commissioner in Macomb County, Candace Miller, said it right. The Fraser is the canary in the tunnel. Really, this is going to happen in other areas across the state. We just aren't aware of it, and we do need to get our arms around this situation.
I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't note you're leading this Fix My State campaign. Of course, you're going to benefit if the state does start investing in fixing up things. So why wouldn't we eye your group with a little more than a little skepticism?
The contractors that we represent, and happy to announce that we do represent, they're the folks that are actually trying to fix the situation. Yes, they benefit from it. They're in the business of fixing our roads, fixing our sewers, fixing our water lines. But that's what the general public wants. There aren't many other groups calling on the public to engage in this issue. We're saying it's not just us. It's not just the contractors that should be concerned about this. We believe that the general public, that the citizens across the state should actually engage in this. Take a look at our website, fixmystate.org, and see for yourself the issues going on across the state. Get your own information. All we do is put facts on there from other groups, and ultimately, we hope that those facts help to drive the general public to push their elected officials to do the right thing.
Just to clarify, since this is radio, it's fixmistate.org. So that's Mike Nystrom with the Michigan Infrastructure and Transportation Association. Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
In Lorraine Boissonneau's book, The Last Voyageurs, the author immerses the reader into the 1977 reenactment of LaSalle's expedition and the perils of the Great Lakes. West Michigan writer and farmer Joan Donaldson has this review.
Reed Lewis, a French teacher from Elgin, Illinois, conceived of the modern Odyssey. He wanted to prove that young men could live under the same primitive conditions as the 17th century voyageurs. Starting in Montreal, seven adults and 16 teenagers paddled 3,300 miles down to the mouth of the Mississippi River. In his pursuit for authenticity, Mr. Lewis and his teens, along with several professional advisors, built their six canoes, hand-sewed their costumes, and memorized songs of the voyageurs. Each member assumed a French identity, including a priest who accompanied them. Lewis became LaSalle in his knee breeches and ruffled shirt. The teens studied the explorers' journals so when visiting communities they could answer questions with accuracy. Lewis also prepared the men to handle personality conflicts, and he instructed them in survival skills. When a canoe capsized and the young men were plunged into a frigid Lake Michigan, that knowledge saved their lives. Throughout the tale, Boissonneau weaves historical data into the narrative, and this information enriches the modern events. The author compares the similarities between the contemporary Lewis and the 17th century LaSalle as they wrestle with raising money for their expeditions, as well as their struggles to manage their men. Both Lewis and LaSalle recognize the significance of the Great Lakes. For LaSalle, the territory beckoned to him because of the incredible natural resources and important waterways for transportation. Lewis wanted to honor the rich history of America's heartland that was often overlooked. Readers will also be drawn in by this coming-of-age story. At the time of the 1977 expedition, Lewis was weary of how adults criticized young people for their lack of discipline. The narrative shows how over the 8-month-long expedition, the teens are transformed into a rugged community who endure physical, emotional, and psychological hardships that shape their characters. In contrast to the French voyageurs who coped with the raw wilderness and tense moments with the Native Americans, the teens face the conflict of living as 17th century men while traveling through a 20th century civilization. When the waterways freeze due to the severe winter, the men resort to trudging down an Indiana back road, where four of them are hit by a truck, but survive. A short epilogue transports the reader 3.5 decades forward into a reunion of the now middle-aged voyageurs. Most have married and turned into white-collar professionals. As the men share their memories, an underlying question surfaces. Because so few people remember the modern-day expedition, did it have any value? Yes, the men agree. Working towards a common goal developed their courage, determination, and self-confidence. They have never forgotten the generosity of strangers who witnessed a majestic reenactment of 17th century history. For readers, this narrative acts as a portal to Michigan's early days. Come paddle along with the voyageurs for a glimpse of what LaSalle experienced when he explored the Great Lakes.
Joan Donaldson writes from her organic blueberry farm near Saugatuck. Her novel, On Viney's Mountain, won the 2010 Friends of American Writers Award. Her essay is part of an ongoing series, Michigan Bookmark. You can find her essay and others at michiganradio.org. Coming up on the next idea, addiction problem? There's an app for that. We'll meet the team behind it. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham and for Cynthia Canty. Today's business column from Daniel Howes in the Detroit News is about the Q Line. That's the new streetcar system that will run along 3.3 miles of Woodward Avenue in Detroit. Daniel joins us now. So what do you think the Q Line represents for Detroit?
Well, I think it's another step in what I call the reinvention of Detroit. I'm not a fan of the concepts of comeback and renaissance because I think Detroit is actually having to reinvent itself as a smaller, more vibrant city. And, you know, you look around, not only in the United States, but around the world, almost any major city has got a serious, incredible transit system. And for a city that put the world on wheels, you would think that Detroit might be a little more savvy about that. And I think that this move that we're getting right now with Q Line is only the beginning. I think the people who are behind it believe that within the next 10 years, they're going to have a line that goes all the way to M59 up Woodward that goes out Jefferson, that goes out Michigan Avenue, and they're going to have a system here. People have to come to terms with the fact that personal transportation and the personal automobile is not going to be the only mode of transportation going forward. There's a lot of societal change and people pushing in different areas and a lot of people who don't really want to own a car, they just want transportation. So I think you're going to see not only this kind of public transit, but also what's called the last mile stuff, which is the Ubers and the Lyfts of the world that take people from a station, let's say up at West Grand Boulevard, and takes them to their home 2 miles away.
You note the streetcar has its critics, and I've heard them too. One person asked me, and I'll ask you, why is the Q Line going to be any more successful than the frequently derided people mover in downtown Detroit?
Well, for one thing, it's happening in a very different time in the city. I mean, the people mover, as it was running, the city was becoming depopulated. I think where you've got the Q Line is along some of the most repopulated areas of the city. If people would come down there and walk around the lower Woodward and start to, and then drive up Woodward towards New Center, I think you'd be astonished in seeing how many storefronts are are filled or under construction. I was just walking around there again yesterday. It's a totally different vibe. Now, I don't think that you can judge this on 6 months and say, well, have you reached 5,000 riders a week? And if you haven't, then it's a failure. I think it's going to take some time to kind of judge that and see what kind of acceptance there is. And as people kind of understand what the patterns and the usefulness is of it to them. But I think it's up to them to judge. It's not up to someone who's sitting out in the suburbs lobbing cheap shots from the comfort of their keyboard. It's the person that has moved downtown or lives near Wayne State and is working down at Campus Martius who decides whether or not this makes sense for them or doesn't. And that's going to be the ultimate arbiter. It's not going to be armchair critics.
Yeah, I'm wondering what this is going to do for the parking decks down there that are in some cases charging some pretty steep parking fees when you can park somewhere cheaper and take the queue line in.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And, you know, Detroit parking, those of us that work in the Detroit News and the Detroit Free Press got a very rude awakening a couple years ago when we moved offices and left our historic homes and all of a sudden had to pay market rate for parking. We'd had it very good for a very long time. It was a rude awakening, and I think that's exactly right. And I think for some people it's going to make more sense. You know, you have appointments. I've had situations where I have appointments in different parts of downtown. In fact, I have some of those today. And getting on the queue line would be very convenient to avoid doing some of that.
The officials with M1 Rail, the organization behind queue line, like to note what a mix of private and donated money went into the queue line. They don't trumpet all that much the federal and state tax dollars that went into it, and it was pretty substantial. How will we know if there's a real return on that taxpayer investment?
That's a good question. I mean, I think ridership's going to be part of it. I think the other thing, that point that the M1 organizers make is, that typically on $150 million or so investment, you would expect to get $600 or $800 million in spinoff investment along the line that has been put in. They just recently released a study that was financed by the Kresge Foundation that looked at development going back to 2013, that since 2013 there's been $7 billion of investment along the Q Line corridor, either completed, underway, or in the works. So, I mean, I think when you start to look at it, I think one of the biggest payoffs is going to be what kind of development and investment there is along the line. And does it start to move away from Woodward? That's going to be another tab to look at. At the end of the day, I think the reinvention of Detroit is a process. It's not a destination. And a lot of people are very impatient and cynical and, you know, say, well, this isn't sufficient. This hasn't done it. Well, no single thing. Not a Q line, not the restructuring of Detroit's finances, not the grand bargain, not District Detroit by the Illich family, not Dan Gilbert buying all those buildings. No single thing is going to create the reinvention. It's going to be a process that's going to take time.
Daniel Hiles is the business columnist for Detroit News. Today's column is Q line, next step in Detroit reinvention. Daniel, thanks much.
Thanks, Lester.
You're listening to Stateside. If you miss any part of today's show, you can find it on our podcast. Just go to michiganradio.org and click on podcasts to find a link.
Experimentation.
Vision.
The next idea.
People mean very different things whenever they talk about innovation.
It seems there's a new story a week about opioid addiction or meth use. Addiction, and here's an unfortunate way to put it, addiction is trending. Finding a way to help people shake addiction, whether it's drugs, alcohol, or other, is tough. People are different. Alcoholic Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous programs don't work for everyone. So how can dealing with addiction be more accessible, more customized? Well, there's a startup company at Ann Arbor that has an idea. Joining me now for today's The Next Idea are Lisa McLaughlin and Robin McIntosh. They're the co-founders of the startup Work It Health. So let's start out. What is Work It?
Work It Health is a digital startup that meets people where they are and provides them with virtual addiction care from their employers. So it's a 90-day program that people go through from their own home that helps them recover at their own pace from any addiction that they might be struggling with.
Now, you say virtual. Basically, this is online counseling. How does it work?
We combine online exercises with one-on-one coaching from licensed addiction counselor. Somebody enters the program and they start right away with the first section, which we call My Mission. They start right away with goal setting. So they set a goal for themselves. And then with the help of a counselor, they agree upon a tailored to them plan, a care coordination plan. And then they go through a series of exercises and chat with their counselor whenever they need that counselor. And that's it.
Lisa, where did this idea originate?
This is an old idea that Robin and I have been kind of working over in our heads for a number of years. But since we met in the recovery community in 2009, we've been continuously dissatisfied with the app landscape for addiction. There's a host of drink trackers and other kinds of sobriety counters that people can go through. But when you're in the middle of Silicon Valley and there's all these incredible startups coming out with top-notch diabetes care, stroke care, all kinds of really top-notch digital services, you get really disappointed when you search for addiction in an app store. And so really, we've been thinking for a long time that the app store options were mediocre for addiction and that we could do better.
You just mentioned all these apps for all these different things. When did technology really jump into that? Because this is news to me.
With the emergence of the iPhone, I guess, in 2007, that's when you started to see some health companies playing around with this idea of apps and digital interventions. Around 2009, certain startups were tackling this in other areas, for instance, Omada Health and Diabetes. So they did a totally digital intervention when it came to diabetes. Studies found that a digital intervention and e-therapy work as well as analog services and in-person.
How do you get funding for something like this?
Well, we identify as a social enterprise, and so you really can draw from a mix of sources to fuel a triple bottom line company. We started with traditional venture.
We've heard of triple bottom line on this program. Basically, business, whether it's profit or nonprofit, with a conscience.
Exactly.
Okay. You guys were in the Bay Area. How did you get from there to Michigan?
I was born in Detroit, and I grew up here. And my time in the Bay Area, I spent about 7 years in Silicon Valley working in the technology field. But over the course of the time that I was away, I had initially gotten sober in the recovery community in Ann Arbor in 2002. And a ton of individuals that I knew started to pass away back home. And I had worked in the clinical community here. I'd worked at the University of Michigan Addiction Research Center. I'd worked with a number of shelters like the Ozone House for runaway and homeless youth. And I just started to see an incredible uptick in death in the community. And it seemed like there was a huge problem here. So as we started to tackle addiction seriously as a company, we wanted to be where we understood the clinical community and where we understood how to make an impact at every level, political, community-based. That's what drew us back. And also a real sense of economic inequality with startups. So there's startups all over the country. But the newer markets and smaller startup markets are really special in the sense that entrepreneurs bound themselves together because there's less of us. And it just seemed like a special opportunity to have a clinical community here.
I'm wondering how your experience in Silicon Valley informed your strategy for a startup like this.
I don't hail from Michigan. I'm from Toronto, which is close, but I went to University of Michigan.
We allow Canadians in all the time. It's good.
Thank you. I have my seat here. But yeah, so when Lisa mentioned wanting to move the company headquarters to Ann Arbor, I was all for it because I know what this town can do, and I know that I graduated with some of the smartest people. I think the talent pool is so rich here. But as far as Silicon Valley, that's where we met, and that's where we worked together in previous startups. There's a real emphasis on lean startup mentality. So there's a real emphasis on agility and moving fast. And sometimes you do not get that in the academic community. You know, in the academic circles, you move slow, you publish a paper once a year, and it's a, you know, a trickle process. But for us, that agility and that speed is so imperative to solving this rapidly growing epidemic. We need to be able to keep pace with this thing that's plaguing the country at a rapid rate.
So the idea is you take this service, you go to an employer, and you say, make this available to your employees. But the employer never knows who they're serving, right? You guys do this with the employee anonymously. Why is that important?
It's pivotal. The thing that's been missing in addiction care is privacy. So we have a whole host of individuals that are not yet ready to be public about their addictions, that are struggling in silence, and allowing them a way that's completely without shame to access help with the support of their employer is really a game changer for them. Employers really want to see change in their population. They don't like doing this kind of top-down compliance, talk to someone about how they behaved at the party last weekend any more than the people like having that conversation on the receiving end. But there is an understanding that care is needed, and there are embarrassing moments at those parties, and there are conversations that need to be had.
To jump on that on a more macro level, all employers that we talk to, no matter if they're 10,000 people or 30,000 people or 100,000 people, all of them have newspapers and they see headlines. You have this opioid epidemic sweeping the nation and they know it's an issue at work. 7 out of 10 companies in America have opioid problems in their offices. They know it's a problem, but they can't talk about it. It's the pink elephant in the room. So we come in and we say, hey, we have this private intervention. People can sign up with their first names and we'll be transparent about how well they do in the program. We can solve this for you, both with prevention and treatment.
Do you have any major clients as of yet?
Yeah, we do. We work with Steelcase on the western side of the state, and we have some other clients that are in the legal field that would prefer to remain anonymous for obvious reasons.
Right. I understand that.
And then we also work with a number of health centers across the country. We started with Michigan because that's where our roots were, but we've also been partnered with UCLA and been a part of several prestigious accelerators in the healthcare space, mostly in the Southern California market.
How do you know whether WorkIt actually works for people?
We have graduates of the program, and because we started with clinical outcomes as our North Star and we run clinical trials to test that the program works with third parties, because of those two things, we check in early and often with each user. At the beginning of entering WorkIt, they set two goals. So one, they set an addictive behaviors goal. Say I'm drinking. My goal is to get my drinking from 10 glasses a week a night. Well, we rate it on a 1 to 10 measure. So my goal is to go from an 8 to a 4. On an addictive behavior scale. And that can be drinking, that can be opioids, that can be using. But we do have two different tracks. There's the moderation track and the abstinence track. But I set that goal specifically around addictive behaviors. The other measure that we take is a quality of life measure. We use the Cantrell scale. Based on these two things, if we're able to move the needle, if we are able to get them closer to their goal on that sliding scale of addictive behaviors, so if they're able to reduce or meet their own preset goals, and we're able to increase their quality of life, we consider that a success, as do our institutional partners and enterprise clients.
When somebody meets their goal, the one that they set for themselves, is there any follow-up?
Mm-hmm. 2 years.
2 years?
Yeah. We follow up. The beginning of WorkIt is called WorkIt Core, and that is the 90-day program that Lisa was talking about. After WorkIt Core, you enter WorkIt Onward, which is 2 years. It's a 2-year follow-up. It's a really light intervention. We kind of think of it as graduate school, and it's where they deal with meatier life issues like marital strife or, you know, financial well-being and that kind of stuff. But we do check in with them on a monthly basis when they're in Onward. After 2 years, we're a young company. We'll probably have a game plan when it comes to it.
I have to ask you about, you know, employers understand they might have problems within their workforce, but why are they drawn to this program? What benefit is it for them beyond any other program that might be out there or available?
There's really a landscape of solutions that are poorly matched to this problem. So there's these employee assistance programs that are really like call referral centers where you call them if you're getting a divorce, you call them if you want to work on your will, you call them if you want to work on a rehab location problem, but they're not necessarily providing deep care. And then there's a host of new entrants to the market that are really digital health companies that are saying, hey, we'll give you pedometers, we'll track your steps, we'll be sort of well-being coaches. But you don't want to take a person with an opioid addiction and give them a well-being coach and say, here's a pedometer. That's not going to help with your painkiller problem. And so we approach companies that know they have this problem on multiple levels. They're self-insured, they see it in their claims data, they see it in their workman's comp data, and they know that they need something more targeted.
How do the costs of WorkIt compare to other programs?
Well, because of the digital nature of our program, we work it really with really healthy margins. So we're $750 flat fee for every person that enters WorkIt. That compares the next step up in care from a digital intervention like WorkIt would be something like an outpatient service, and that can run you $650 a day. So we're a lot cheaper.
So what's the long-term goal for the firm? Where are you going with this?
We imagine that we're building the equivalent of a Mayo Clinic for addiction. We started with the WorkIt Care program, laying the clinical groundwork and curating the best of the best faculty and medical doctors to support our initiative. And from there, we really want to extend it. We have really, really bold goals. We want to see a cure for addiction. We want to see new services and new frameworks and new ways of talking about this problem. And we're building that bit by bit, starting with the pieces that we know best and that we're best suited to execute on and moving out from there to more medical interventions.
To piggyback on that, I think we would like to be a household name. There's this saying in the recovery community that AA is the last house on the block. And upon deep personal inspection of that theory, we found that to be true. You know, this is a system that we know intimately as patients, as designers, and it's the only house on the block for a lot of people because of the prohibitively expensive and inaccessible nature of addiction treatment. And so we want to be another house on the block.
We've been talking to WorkIt co-founders. That's spelled W-O-R-K-I-T, and all you have to do is put that in the Google and you will find their site right away. Co-founders are Lisa McLaughlin and Robin McIntosh. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
This was fun.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Coming up later, we'll hear from one of the first women to publicly accuse Michigan State University Dr. Larry Nassar of sexual abuse.
It's not the man in the trench coat. It's not the white van with no windows. It's your trusted physician. It's your school principal. It's the pillar in the community that has positioned himself to be in a position where no one is going to question.
Stay with us. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. A former federal prosecutor is calling for an independent special counsel to investigate any ties between Donald Trump's campaign and Russia now that President Trump has fired the director of the FBI. Barbara McQuaid is the former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan, and she joins us now. Now, in the interest of full disclosure, we should note that you and other U.S. attorneys were fired by President Trump, which is not all that unusual with a change in the presidency. Now, with that out of the way, you wrote an opinion piece that was published in the Washington Post. Why did you feel compelled to write it?
Well, I wanted to share the viewpoint really in defense of law enforcement about how important independence is in the criminal justice system. You know, there's all kinds of political chatter going on from the right and the left. And I think those of us who work in law enforcement really take great pride in tuning out that noise and working on the facts. And so I was troubled that Director Comey had been fired. It concerns me, and I think it really elevates the call we've heard from other corners about the need now for an independent counsel just to insulate this decision from any political outcry. At some point, someone's going to have to decide whether to charge or not charge someone with some crimes relating to the Russia interference. And I think to have public confidence in that decision, we want it to be done by someone with independence.
Let's talk about Comey for a second. There are Democrats and there are Republicans who don't like James Comey. Democrats because of the way he dealt with the Clinton email investigation, and Republicans because he's contradicted President Trump's claims that he was wiretapped by Barack Obama. What do you know about Comey?
Well, I know him a little bit. I see him as someone who's very independent, very much his own man. And I think that's one of the things that I like about him. He is revered within law enforcement circles, I think, because he is a strong and independent leader, which they really pride themselves on in law enforcement.
Right. You know a lot of FBI agents. You probably talk to them.
I do. And he was revered. He was really well respected because he cared deeply about the mission, but also because it was clear he wasn't going to be pushed around from the right or the left. He served under Republicans. He served under Democrats. And sometimes he made decisions that were unpopular with the party that appointed him. But I think that's what we want in a law enforcement leader, is someone who's going to call, you know, balls and strikes as he sees them and not be influenced by partisan politics.
What did you think of the reasons outlined by President Trump and the Justice Department recommendations to fire Comey?
They strike me as a little odd, especially in terms of the timing. The memo that was written for the basis for the firing related to his handling of the Clinton email investigation to her detriment last July, based on President Trump's public comments. That's very different from how he viewed the situation.
During the campaign, right.
And if you thought that was improper in July, why wait until now to fire him? Why not fire him January 20th when President Trump first took office? So it seemed, at least to suggest to me, I had some skepticism that that was the one and only reason for the firing.
There is concern that Comey was involved in this investigation into Russian collusion or interference in the elections. It's been pointed out to me that the FBI director doesn't actually conduct investigations. FBI special agents do, and they'll continue to investigate without Comey. So how does firing Comey change anything?
Well, no doubt there are agents in the field who are dedicated, who are agents of integrity, who will continue to do their work on this and other cases. But, you know, ultimately someone at the very highest levels is going to have to make a decision in this case, a recommendation to Justice Department lawyers about whether to prosecute or not prosecute. In a case this sensitive, that decision is going to come from the very highest level. So whoever is his replacement is going to have to say to those agents, thanks for your work, we're going to recommend prosecution or not. And I think that's where the importance of having an independent decision maker is critically important.
We don't know who President Trump might appoint as FBI director, whomever that might be. How difficult will it be for people to have confidence that that person is independent of the White House?
I think it's a real uphill battle. I think that whoever that person is going to have to be someone with a track record of independence. And there are plenty of people out there. But this person also will have to be confirmed by the Senate. So we'll have a chance, I think, to explore some of that person's motivation and experience and history through Senate confirmation hearings. And based on what I've been hearing from both parties, I think both parties are concerned and want to make sure that that person can have public confidence in any decision that he or she makes.
Why do you recommend a special counsel, an independent prosecutor, to investigate this Russia-Trump campaign connection?
There had already been people calling for an independent counsel just to avoid any appearance that people appointed by President Trump are those investigating and making charging decisions on a case that could ultimately implicate him or his administration. I think that creates an appearance of a conflict of interest. Now that President Trump has fired the FBI director, who's in charge of making that investigative recommendation about whether to bring charges, it's really sort of escalated the need to have an independent counsel. The most important thing is that the public have confidence that that decision is made on facts and law and not politics. Taking it out of that chain of command at the Department of Justice to someone who's independent will help instill public confidence in the decision.
Senator Mitch McConnell, the majority leader, says there's really no need for a special prosecutor. There are committees in the Senate and in the House. They're conducting investigations. Why is that not enough?
They have a very different purpose, and those investigations are important, too, and I'm pleased that they're going on. But in the FBI and at the Department of Justice, of course, the purpose of an investigation is for criminal charges. The Senate or the House, I suppose, could lead to impeachment proceedings, but it may not relate to the president. You may find someone else within government has acted inappropriately. And so I think their functions are very different, and that's why an independent counsel is necessary for the criminal investigation.
The Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, would typically decide whether to appoint a special counsel, but Sessions has recused himself from the Russia investigation. That leaves the decision up to Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. What do you know about him?
I worked alongside him. He was the U.S. Attorney in Baltimore during the time I was U.S. Attorney in Detroit. And you know, he is someone who was not only the U.S. Attorney during the Obama administration, he had been the U.S. Attorney during the Bush administration. So he is really widely respected as someone who is nonpartisan, who is respected in law enforcement circles. I have confidence in his decision making, and I'm hopeful that he will understand the point I'm making about the need for public confidence and go ahead and appoint an independent counsel just to diminish some of this political charge from this case.
How likely do you think that is?
I think it's likely. You know, the last time we saw this was when Scooter Libby was charged with leaking information
Dick
about
Cheney's aide. Yeah.
Yeah, he had been an aide to Dick Cheney. So that's the kind of scenario where, you know, whether the prosecutor is or isn't biased, and probably not, but it creates a public perception that you are, you know, investigating and charging the very people you work for. There's an inherent conflict of interest there. So it was done in that case. It's been done in other cases. Ken Starr in the Whitewater investigation, for example. This is a perfect case for an independent counsel. There's not a real serious downside to doing it. I mean, other than inefficiency, I suppose. You can't have an independent counsel investigating everything or it'd be difficult to get your work done. There is a commitment of resources to doing it.
Although Ken Starr was criticized for really taking his authority to the nth degree and spending a lot of money.
He went well beyond the scope of the Whitewater investigation, I believe, in that case. So you're right. So there is some potential downside that the case could go far afield. But, you know, in this case, again, where public confidence is so important, I think an independent counsel would be appropriate.
So what if nothing happens? No special counsel. The FBI is told by the new director to end the investigation.
I suppose that could happen. And oftentimes we don't really know what's going on. We don't know what the facts are. I think that would create a lot of public suspicion and skepticism and ultimately undermines the legitimacy of our institutions of government. It's so important that the public have faith in what the FBI does, in what the Justice Department does. I love the Department of Justice. I have loved it because of its mission. We are not the Department of Prosecution, the Department of Public Safety. We are the Department of Justice, which means we do the right thing. If people don't have confidence in that going forward, I think it really creates chaos.
Barbara McQuaid is the former U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan, currently a law professor at the University of Michigan. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks very much, Lester.
There's so much to talk about in this diverse state of ours that we can't possibly know about at all. That's where you come in. We want to know what you're curious about. If you have a question about Michigan, something you always wondered about, send it along by going to Stateside at our page at michiganradio.org. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Tomorrow, seven women and girls are expected to testify against a doctor they say sexually abused them. They are some of the more than 100 women and girls who've alleged Dr. Larry Nassar abused them while they were in gymnastic programs at Michigan State University or USA Gymnastics. Nassar was team physician for both. The first person to take the stand will be Rachel Den Hollander, and she joins us now. What are you thinking today, knowing you'll be testifying against Nassar tomorrow, that he'll be there, the news media will be there?
You know, I feel a sense of relief that it's ending, that his ability to prey on women and children, I believe, is coming to an end very swiftly. But there's also definitely a sense of pain. It's going to be a painful process. And I think that's an aspect that we don't understand very well in society. I think that the lack of understanding for the ramifications of sexual assault is something that we need to do a much better job understanding. And I think you see some of that lack of understanding coming out with the way USAG and MSU both handled claims of sexual assault against Larry Nassar from 1997 on.
I want to talk about that a little later, but I want to ask you, of those people to testify tomorrow, you're the only one to actually reveal your name. The other six decided not to. Why did you decide to go public?
I was convinced it was the only way to be able to put a stop to what he was doing. When someone has the persona and particularly the institutions behind him with the level of power and authority that Larry Nassar had in MSU and USAG, the unfortunate reality is that an anonymous voice is not enough. It was not a decision I wanted to make. It was never something I wanted to do, but it is the unfortunate reality of the culture that we live in.
How have people reacted since you went public?
You know, I've gotten a lot of support from family and friends, and I'm very, very grateful for that. For the most part, I really have tried to stay out of reading public comments and blogs, and off of that, it's not constructive and it's not helpful many times. And so, to be perfectly honest, I really can't tell you what's happening out in the world of internet comments, because that's not relevant to me.
Probably pretty wise as well. Going public and talking about what you must be a horrific memory. Again and again to people like me. How has that affected you?
It's been very painful. Having to do this publicly is something I will, I think I'll always regret having to do it this way. But there are dynamics that are more important than what I want and than what I feel. And that is the ability to protect the women that are coming after me. You know, for 16 years, I did not have that ability, and I do now. And that's more important than what I want.
The Washington Post obtained email exchanges of Michigan State University officials. What did that report tell you about the relationship between the school and the doctor?
I think it really confirmed a lot of the institutional problems that allowed someone like Larry Nassar to continue preying on women and children for decades. You know, and there are a lot of women that have come forward since my testimony saying, you know, I spoke to Kathy Klages, I spoke to people in the athletic training department, you know, the woman who filed a claim in 2004 with the Meridian Township Police, and the woman in 2014 who filed a Title IX claim and a claim with the MSU Police. And so I think we saw a lot of those problems. But to see Dean Stramble saying so blatantly to Larry Nassar, I'm on your side. Irrespective of the evidence that I had brought, irrespective of my claim, that was really painful. And it really confirmed, once again, the institutional dynamics that allowed someone like Nassar to prey on children for 20 years.
You mentioned William Strample. He's the dean of the College of Osteopathic Medicine and Larry Nassar's boss. You wrote open letters to him and to Michigan State University President Lou Anna K. Simon after the revelations in the Washington Post. What did you want them and us to know?
You know, my concern at this point as it relates to MSU and USAG is that it really doesn't appear that they're learning the lessons they need to learn to prevent something like this from happening again. The unfortunate reality is that a pedophile is only going to be as prolific as the people around him allow him to be. And the reason Nassar was able to continue preying on women and children for decades is because there was deliberate indifference to the claims of the children that were coming forward and saying, look, this is what he's doing under the guise of medical treatment. There was deliberate indifference to the red flags, to the claims of sexual assault. And that resulted in dozens and dozens of women who have suffered abuse that they did not need to suffer. And my greatest concern going forward is that I can do everything in my power to stop Larry Nassar. But unless MSU and USAG change the way that they handle sexual assault, unless they can recognize the problems that they had and the dynamics that they created that allowed someone like Larry Nassar to continue preying on children, unless there's a full recognition of those dynamics, they're not going to be making the kinds of changes that will prevent someone from coming up to take his place. And there's a lot of discussion of, well, we're doing internal investigations and we're going to make changes. But you can't make changes if you don't recognize the problems that you already have. And to this point, there's not only been no recognition of those problems, but there's been a statement made even by President Simon that it's virtually impossible to catch a predator. That's not a recognition of what MSU has done to this point. That really is a washing hands and a walking away, in effect.
What specifically would you like to see changed at Michigan State and USA Gymnastics?
Well, I think some of those dynamics are going to continue evolving as we, you know, as we get more information. A lot of it, I think, will relate to how people individually handle claims of sexual assault, you know, and where precisely those problems lie in MSU. I think we're still learning, but we definitely see some of them with the way Kathy Kalagis handled the claims of assault by the girls.
Tell us who she is.
Kathy Kalagis is a former gymnastics coach at MSU, and there were two women that came forward in 1997 who told Kathy what Larry was doing under the guise of medical treatment. And she basically bullied them into silence, you know, and told one of them, I can file a report, but there's going to be serious ramifications for you if I do. She even called Larry, allegedly, and told him, you know, this is what these girls are saying. And it really silenced these young women who had very bravely come forward to try to shed a light on what was happening and to reach out for help. And the result of that is that they were silenced, and Larry was able to continue and know that he was empowered to continue abusing women for the next 20 years.
Dr. Nassar has been accused of pedophilia, sexually assaulting little girls again and again. Why do you think it's taken so long for this to be taken seriously?
I think that really has to do with what we see with the culture of abuse and the societal response to abuse. You know, the culture of abuse is a catchphrase that's thrown around a lot. Oh, we have a culture of abuse. We have a culture of abuse. But I don't think a lot of people really understand what that means. You know, a culture of abuse is not created by the predator himself. The culture of abuse is a societal response. It's the way we handle disclosures of assault. It's our understanding of the impact of sexual assault. It's our understanding of what sexual assault really can even entail. And you know, there are a lot of these facts that people have in their heads. For example, you know, most people can tell you, oh, sexual assault happens not often by a stranger, but by someone you trust. But the reality of what that can look like, you know, that it's not the man in the trench coat, it's not the white van with no windows, it's your trusted physician, it's your school principal, it's the pillar in the community that has positioned himself to be in a position where no one is going to question, and where childhood victims are going to be silenced and disbelieved. And that's a pattern that we see repeated over and over and over again. There's a reluctance and an unwillingness to deal with sexual assault when it's someone that's a friend or that you trust or that's really even in your own camp.
Rachel Den Hollander, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Michigan Radio News and Stateside have asked to interview Dean William Strample and President Luana K. Simon. Michigan State University has not made them available to us. This week, President Simon, in an online video, asked for patience and referred people to a new website for information from the university about what the school is doing to deal with and to prevent sexual assault. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.